Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we will ask, who's afraid of gender? That's the title of a new book by Judith Butler, distinguished professor in the graduate school at UC Berkeley, whose groundbreaking book called Gender Trouble has frequently been taught in colleges for the last 30 years. They also wrote the influential book Bodies That Matter and other books as well. In their new book, Who's Afraid of Gender?, Butler takes on what they call the anti-gender ideology movement and why it's become so central to conservative politics in the U.S. and abroad. Now, some of you may remember that I talked recently on the show about a promotional mailer I got from the conservative Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, advertising their school and looking for donations, and that the very first line of the letter said, quote, if we're going to save America from the growing threats of socialism, transgenderism, and Marxism, there's only one way we can do it, education. And I thought, which one of these does not belong? And obviously, to me anyway, it was transgenderism. You know, socialism and Marxism, you can believe in them or not, okay, fine. But transgenderism, how you experience your own body as an ism, a belief system, a political philosophy, that was just hate speech, it struck me. So now we can talk to somebody who knows a lot more about this than I do and has put themselves in the crosshairs over it. They've even been burned in effigy and physically attacked. Judith Butler joins us now. Professor Butler, thank you for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Can you start by taking us back to your book, Gender Trouble, by way of introducing yourself to our listeners? What were the politics or cultural context of the 1990s that you were trying to address then?
Well, I suppose it was actually the late 1980s since I wrote the book then. No, that's all right. It appeared in late 1989, so maybe it prefigured the 90s, but it didn't have much to do with them. I was a young professor and certainly in conversation with feminists who thought that heterosexuality was the framework within which you thought about what's a man, what's a woman, what do men want, what do women want. Very often women were identified with motherhood and marriage was conceived of as a heterosexual institution. And all this was obviously before the legalization of gay marriage and the burgeoning of gay and lesbian and single parent parenting. So I was trying to open up the feminist framework and also bring some perspectives from gay and lesbian social movements into that academic discussion. That book focused on gender, and I put forth what is now called the performative theory of gender. Some people think that means, oh, you can choose to be whatever you want. Other people think it means, oh, you're totally socially conditioned and determined and you have no choice. So there were two very different interpretations of what I was doing. But actually, the performative theory of gender was a way of saying we're formed by social power, we enact and embody it, and sometimes we can, in the course of our embodiment, change what it means to be the gender we're assigned. Sometimes we change genders or we change the meaning of that gender, but we do have some freedom.
So I see that you had been writing and speaking about other things, but came back to this topic for the new book because of a terrifying incident when you were on a speaking engagement in Brazil, which was not about gender, if I have this right. Can you tell our listeners some of what happened?
Yes. Well, I have been writing several books on war, on ethics, psychoanalysis, precarious life, another book on the pandemic. So I had wandered away from gender, it's true. It seemed to me there was a fair amount of internecine fighting among people who were working in that field. And I thought maybe there were some other issues that were better thought about by me. But it's true. I was at a conference in Brazil in 2017, and it was on the question of democracy. Are we seeing the end of democracy? Are we seeing rising authoritarianism? What do we do about it? But I arrived at the airport and was quickly ushered through labyrinthine tunnels underneath the São Paulo airport by government officials who were protecting me, apparently from right-wing mobs. And I thought, well, this seems a little overstated. This seems probably unnecessary. But then when I arrived at the venue, I saw that people were already congregating outside and that there were some pretty nasty pictures of me that had been altered and an effigy that was then burnt in the course of that first day. I was sequestered in a room within the venue and watched most of this through pictures or video. But I did see that there were people who associated me with something they called gender ideology, and they associated gender and gender ideology with the work of the devil. So I became somehow the devil, and as such needed to be banished from the land.
Before we get to what they meant by gender ideology and how you interpret it, was there something about Brazil that made that incident more likely there, or how do you now view that attack in the broader cultural and political context of the U.S. and globally too?
Well, first, let me say that the anti-gender ideology movement is a movement that calls itself by that name. So I don't call it that. I discovered it as such and worked with a number of feminists in Eastern Europe, in Turkey, in Latin America, in France, and Belgium to think more clearly about what this movement was. It was inaugurated by the Vatican in the 80s and 90s when Pope Benedict took exception to the idea of gender. He thought that this was a dangerous idea, that it contested the doctrine of creation. God created male and female, the human, as we know it, according to him, and according to Pope Francis as well, only appears in two forms, male and female, and it's God who creates them. Now, if people start deciding on their sex assignment or changing their gender or calling themselves by new names, that's considered by the anti-gender ideology movement, informed by the Vatican, to be stealing God's creative powers. And who steals God's creative powers? Well, the devil does. The devil masquerades as the creative power of God. So that movement moved through Argentina. A couple of important and influential books were written there. And then it entered into several churches that used to be liberation theology churches in Latin America, but were slowly supplanted or taken over by right-wing evangelicals who were against gender and certainly working for a conservative agenda. Jair Bolsonaro, who was about to become the president of Brazil at that time, had already whipped many people into a frenzy about gender ideology, about education, claiming that teaching gender in schools was tantamount to indoctrination. Gender was a new totalitarianism that it had to be stopped, and that their children, were endangered by this demonic ideology. So it makes sense that it was Brazil at that time.
I mentioned that flyer from Hillsdale College in Michigan warning about socialism, Marxism, and transgenderism. Do you accept the notion that there is such a thing as transgenderism?
No, I don't know what that is. I don't even know what gender ideology is, because these are terms that the right has concocted in order to create fear and to recruit people to conservative causes and indeed to increasingly authoritarian candidates in municipal and presidential elections in several countries. So there is no gender ideology. That's a term that's made up by them. Gender is a complex field. Gender is a complex concept. People in gender studies argue all the time about what it means and how we should approach it, whether we can even approach it alone without reference to race, class, to other meaningful social categories, whether we need an intersectional framework, etc. Gender ideology is treated as a monolith. Similarly, transgenderism is a right-wing attribution. It's suggesting that if it's an ism, it's an ideology, that it has, in some sense, falsely convinced people of the ability to change gender or to experience gender in diverse ways. And it's understood as a form of false consciousness. But that's a right-wing construct, so we shouldn't act as if it exists anywhere except in the phantasmatic vocabulary of the right.
And that's a word you use in the book, phantasm. A phantasm, yeah. Meaning a fantasy, something made up?
Well, a phantasm is, it seems like something real that's threatening, that creates fear. But in reality, it collects a series of fears and anxieties, and it stands for them. It also, interestingly enough, conceals them. So let's say we're feeling fear about the future of the planet. Most of us are. We're aware of ecological catastrophe that is already upon us. Or let's say we feel fear about the unending nature of contemporary wars or just how destructive they can become. Or maybe we feel fear that our livelihoods cannot be guaranteed. Labor has become increasingly precarious and neoliberalism has destroyed many social goods and social benefits upon which we used to rely. So we have a lot of fear circulating. A right-wing demagogue can come along and say, oh, guess what? What is the source of your fear? I'll tell you. Gender ideology, or critical race theory, or migrants, or ethnic studies, or those who tell the history, American history, that includes an elaborate and demonstrable history of slavery. In other words, I think a number of left-wing caricatures, and I would include transgenderism among them, are very useful phantasms to the right. They are identified as the true source of what we fear, and there is a kind of promise made that if we could only get rid of all these things, then life will be restored to order, hierarchy, maybe even patriarchy or white supremacy, and at least some people will feel that their place in the world is secure.
So listeners, who's afraid of gender in your life? That's the title of Judith Butler's new book, Who's Afraid of Gender? Anybody have stories of encountering people in the anti-gender ideology movement? And if you are not in that movement, have you engaged them in conversation? Any story you want to tell? Or have you been victimized? We just heard Judith Butler's own story of how they were at risk of being physically attacked and were burned in effigy for a non-related speaking engagement in Brazil. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Who's afraid of gender? Do you have an opinion, by the way, on why categories in this realm use the term phobia, and you have that fear reference in the title, who's afraid of, instead of anti or ist, we say racist, classist, anti-Semitic, but we say homophobic and transphobic more often. I guess people say anti-trans also. But is that just semantics, or does the distinction matter?
Well, I think we have to ask about the relationship between fear and hatred. And I think the phantasm does that. It It draws on fears of gay and lesbian parenting, say, or sex education, or kids changing their genders or wanting to experiment with the change of pronouns. It plays on fears and it helps to transform fears into hatred. So if we want to give a full account of how it is that the anti-gender movement becomes convincing, at least to some, I think we need what I would call a psychosocial analysis, one that understands anxiety, fear, and hatred, and how anxiety and fear can be instrumentalized to produce some pretty terrible forms of hatred.
If there are now university courses and majors and departments in gender studies, does that mean that there are some kinds of belief systems that can be called ideologies to people who study the field as academics or participate as activists?
Well, it depends what you mean by ideology. I mean, ideology does, interestingly enough, come from the left. We can trace it back, perhaps most importantly, to Marx and Engels, the German ideology. I think at that point, Marx and Engels were trying to figure out why people accept capitalism and what are the beliefs that reproduce capitalism. So it's a left-wing concept back then. I think in the 20th century, the term ideology was used by Daniel Bell and others to describe totalitarianism or authoritarianism, belief systems that people come to adopt that actually destroy democracy and don't always work in their favor. Unfortunately, I don't think that can be said about gender, because every gender studies class I've ever been part of is in conflict. People disagree. In fact, I would say gender studies is an example of the contested character of contemporary university life and college life, and even in high schools. People ask questions about gender. Gender is a way of asking questions about presuppositions. It's open critical inquiry. It's open conflict. It's hardly a single idea.
In fact, in a minute, I'm going to read something that a well-known feminist wrote about your book that is critical of it. But we'll get to that. You're going to like this. Here's a text from a listener. It says, "Professor Butler, I'm actually on my way right now to teach your book, Gender Trouble, to my Introduction to Cultural Anthropology course at Wesleyan, and was part of the group that brought you to our campus via Zoom in the fall. And here's their question. If there was one thing you would want to share with students reading your work today, quite literally today, what would it be?"
Well, I think when I wrote Gender Trouble, I accepted in part the idea that there was nature on the one hand and culture on the other hand. I think that was an inheritance from 1980s feminism. And I think now it's much more important to consider that our biological life and our social life are interactive, that that the environment has changed who we are biologically, and who we are biologically also changes the environment. So I would hope to offer a more complex understanding, so that sex is not identified with nature and gender is not identified with culture or society. I think we need to rethink that particular framework according to the wonderful work that's been done in feminist history of science and contemporary philosophy of science. I would change that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that gender trouble belongs to the philosophy of freedom, but it shouldn't be misconstrued as purely individualistic. Many people think of it as a tract that defends personal liberty, but I see it as something that's trying to establish collective freedoms.
Does part of what you just said get back to the tension that I think you were laying out earlier in our conversation, and tell me if I'm characterizing it correctly, between embracing differences through the lens of gender being socially constructed versus more of an innate identity, this is who I am, who I was born as, or tell me if I'm framing a real tension that you see.
Well, that is a real tension, and I'm happy to address that one. And in fact, I would say it's a tension that we also see in contemporary gender theory. There are people who claim, and trans people who claim, my gender is not culturally constructed or socially constructed. It is who I am. It is part of my reality. It is who I've been since the beginning of time. This wasn't formed. This comes with me. And that may well be true in the sense that there are deep and abiding feelings and understandings of identity that have never changed. So I accept that. But when we act politically, when we say, oh, by the way, on the basis of this gender that I am, I want to have rights. I want to be protected from violence. I want to be free to walk down the street at night. I'm asserting that identity in language. I'm making it public. And in that part, in that sense, we are elaborating who we are socially and publicly. So we might be that thing, but we might also have to explain it, present it, make it known, decide the terms by which we appear. And all that is what is meant by construction. Construction does not mean, oh, this is an artifice and can be torn away. No, there are deep realities that might be said to be constructed. But it also doesn't mean we're determined and there's nothing we can do about it. I think the meaning of our lives changes. The meaning of what it is to be a woman has changed enormously. The meaning of what it is to be trans has changed enormously. And we depend on that historical change for our emancipatory movements and our struggles for greater freedom and equality.
I think kind of to some of the points you were just discussing. Nicholas in Dumont, New Jersey, you're on WNYC with Judith Butler. Hi, Nicholas.
Well, hi, I'm right here. Thank you, Brian. This is a really fascinating segment on the show. And I just wanted to state that I'm currently in the middle of a survey anthropology course. And just last week, one of the papers was about the Bugis people in South Asia with five genders. And what my reaction was, yeah, while there may be two sexes, male and female, gender is completely separate from that. And there are other societies. The Navajos are three genders. What does it matter who my next-door neighbor, across-the-street neighbor, what gender they choose? I live my life. Surely in this entire world, there's room for all of us to be accepting of whatever people want to choose. And that's all I have to say. I'll get off the phone now.
But part of that, Nicholas, you were making a distinction between sex and gender, or saying that is a distinction people should remember to make.
One is biology with X and Y chromosomes, and one is something else. It's a societal thing, and you can have what you wish.
Yeah. Nicholas, thank you. Well, he makes it sound like a personal choice on one level. I don't know if you heard it that way. And anything on the distinction between sex and gender, the way you think it's important to make or not?
Well, I appreciate what Nicholas says, and I think he is, in fact, taking a humane and capacious attitude. Like, it doesn't matter what my neighbor's gender is, yeah. Or how they're defining themselves. I think that is exactly true.
Thing.
But there are people who think it does matter, and that if somebody who has changed gender in the course of their lives is living next door, that somehow threatens their own gender or their own family structure or their ways of understanding the world. And of course, those folks have to be convinced that it actually doesn't threaten them. It may be that those who are straight and feel quite at home in the gender they were assigned at birth, maybe they think they're living a life that everyone should be living, or that is the natural or necessary way of life. But all they need to do is understand that it's one form of life and they can have it. But they can't assume that everybody else wants it too or is living it. for some people, that shift, you know, is very hard because they lose a sense of being natural or right or normal, or they have to accept that there's a diversity in human sexuality and also a diversity in gender and gender identification. The only thing I would perhaps question about Nicholas's remark is his idea that male and female are set by chromosomes. If you take a look at a book like Gender Mosaic, Beyond the Myth of the Male and Female Brain, written by Daphna Joel and Anna Vikansky, you will see that there's enormous complexity, both in the way that chromosomes are arranged, but also in endocrinology and in neurology more broadly. So, and we also know from intersex folks and others whose primary or secondary characteristics, sexual characteristics are mixed, that or indeterminate, that that it's been a real struggle getting recognition and rights for those people, because so many within the medical establishment assume that male and female are discrete. But in fact, there's some people will call it a spectrum and others call it a mosaic. I like the mosaic idea. And I think it's perhaps a way to affirm the complexity of the human creature in both its biological and social and historical dimensions.
As our last thing, as we start to run out of time, I do want to bring up the place where you become controversial among some feminists, and that's your take on the so-called trans-exclusionary radical feminists. And I want to read a little stretch here from a somewhat critical review of your book in The Atlantic by the feminist writer Katha Pollitt, writing about you. Katha Pollitt writes, "They dismiss, with that invocation of a phantasm, apprehension about the presence of trans women in women's single-sex spaces, as well as, gender crits would add, biological men falsely claiming to be trans in order to gain access to same, concerns for biologically female athletes who feel cheated out of scholarships and trophies, and the slight a biological woman might experience by being referred to as a menstruator. Butler wants to dismiss gender crits as fascist adjacent. Indeed, in an interview, they compare Stock, the philosopher Kathleen Stock, and J.K. Rowling to Putin and the Pope." Would you respond to that?
Yes. Well, you know, I have great respect for Katha Pollitt, but I am surprised that she didn't read the text carefully. And of course, emotions do run high on this issue, especially among feminists and sometimes intergenerationally. But I have never said that Kathleen Stock or J.K. Rowling are fascist adjacent, but I have said that I hope that trans-exclusionary feminists who make the same kinds of arguments as Putin, as Orban and Maloney, would ask themselves why it is that their arguments ally with right-wing authoritarians. And I make clear that I think this is an unwitting alliance. I don't think they're embracing fascism. I don't think they are fascists. I've never said any such thing. But I think they do have to ask themselves why their alliance is there rather than with gay, lesbian, queer, trans, gender nonconforming people. Because if you look at feminist organizations in Latin America, organizations that are dedicated to opposing violence against women, both in private spaces and in public spaces and in education and prisons, they always include an opposition to violence done against trans and travestis because the same people who are attacking women violently and very often murdering them are attacking trans people as well. And that the alliance between us has to get firmer if we are to oppose the anti-gender people. Now, we have to also remember that the anti-gender ideology movement, and think Putin, Orban, Meloni, Bolsonaro, many, many leaders, but many right-wing Christian nationalists as well, in Texas and in Florida, they are against reproductive rights for women. They are against anti-discrimination laws for women. They're against feminism. They're against gay and lesbian parenting. They are against sex education courses. They want to take down explicitly nude pictures from arts institutions. They are targeting critical race theory and ways in which history is taught. We actually need a very large alliance, which includes feminists and queer people and gay and lesbian and people who are fighting racism and people who are trying to open the borders to migrants and to establish decent and lawful forms of passage for migration to the United States. All of this is related. We are being targeted more effectively by the right than we are gathering ourselves as an alliance. And that is really sad. So in some ways, my book is an appeal to the trans-exclusionary feminists to rethink their stance. They don't have to applaud or love trans people or even come to understand them as deeply as I wish they would. But they do need to be in alliance with them against the right, because if feminism is not on the left, and if it's not in alliance against rising authoritarianism, then what is feminism? It makes no sense to me. We can't be against discrimination against women, but for discrimination against trans people, that makes us completely contradictory. It also means we're not reading the political situation we are in or taking up the kinds of alliances that are most necessary now, especially as a possible Trump victory looms.
Judith Butler, distinguished professor in the graduate school at UC Berkeley, is now the author of Who's Afraid of Gender? Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you. At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and yes, New York City may have just taken a major step toward allowing driverless cars on its streets. Are you scared yet? Mayor Eric Adams and the city's Department of Transportation unveiled a set of safety requirements for autonomous vehicle testing. They unveiled it last week. They also announced a new permitting program for companies that want to test the technology on a street near you. Now, to be clear and to be fair, these autonomous vehicles, as they're called, won't immediately be driverless anytime soon. One of the newly released safety requirements is for a trained driver to be behind the wheel, at least for now. So what exactly does driverless or autonomous mean in New York City, and what exactly are we in for? Let's ask Sam Schwartz, former longtime Gridlock Sam columnist in the Daily News, former New York City Traffic Commissioner, President and CEO of Sam Schwartz Pedestrian Traffic Management, and author of the book, which is 6 years old now, so this is not a brand new topic, No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars and the Road of the Future. Sam, always great to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
So let me ask you the 101 question first for people who are just getting their heads around even this concept. What's a driverless car, autonomous car, robo car, whatever you want to call it? How does it actually work?
It usually has one or as many as three of the following devices: machine vision, so it can discern whether it's a person, a dog, a log in the road, LIDAR, which is kind of like light radar, and radar itself to be able to bounce off objects, And then it has an algorithm in its computer system that decides to proceed, to stop. It could read signs. It could read speed limit signs. It can do many things. When you're in an environment with no people, it works perfectly. The real problem is people.
Because there are no robo-pedestrians and humans make human errors?
Yeah. The New Yorker, first of all, the New York market is a pretty tough one. New Yorkers don't stand on the curb waiting for the light to change. They take the first few feet of the roadway. Is their trajectory going into the path of that car? Those are all decisions that have to be made by an algorithm, which has to be made by a computer geek somewhere that decides that the New York pedestrian will stop. Most of us make eye contact. We figure out they're not going. We could proceed. But a machine has a very difficult time doing that.
The mayor and the Department of Transportation have made it clear, as I said in the intro, that for now, autonomous vehicles will be required to have a so-called safety driver behind the wheel. What does the human in that role do?
There's something called disengagements in autonomous vehicles. A disengagement is sometimes the autonomous vehicle will tell you, uh-oh, I don't know what to do. Take over. And in some cases, you're riding in that autonomous vehicle in the driver's seat and you see it going into a barrier or a person and you hit the brake. So the purpose of that individual is to deal with both automatic disengagements by the vehicle and disengagements based on what the driver does. That's a really tough job. The average disengagement, I was looking at some statistics, occurs every 600 miles. That means for 599 miles, the person is doing nothing. For that person to then be alert on the 600th mile is pretty difficult. So I've spoken to some of the operators, and it's one of the worst jobs. And sadly, the person who gets hung, should there be a tragedy, which happened in Phoenix, is that driver who was looking down at her phone as the car detected a pedestrian, but the algorithm said, forget about it, hit the woman. She was walking a bike across the road and killed her. Hmm. The AV company did not get hung, but the operator got hung, making minimum wage.
And I imagine it's a difficult decision for a person because if you're actually driving the car, you're looking at everything that you can see. And you know that any decision that has to be made is your decision. If it's an autonomous vehicle, first, the person who's also in there behind the wheel has to decide, should I intervene or not? And that takes time, right?
Yeah, that takes, could take a half second. It could take a second. And at 60 miles an hour, you're moving at 90 feet a second. So a second or a fraction of a second really matters.
So in the statement from the mayor announcing the new permitting program and safety requirements, he said this of autonomous vehicles, quote, this technology is coming whether we like it or not, so we're going to make sure that we get it right, quote from Mayor Adams last week. Is the future inevitably driverless on the streets of New York City, at least in part? The mayor suggests it is. Do you agree?
I agree with the fact that we may see some autonomous vehicles. I think the mayor's approach, there are some mistakes in it. First, he calls for self-certification of these vehicles, whether they've been in crashes or not. This is the most opaque industry I have ever seen in my life. They don't share anything. It's unlike when Volvo did the three-point seatbelt shoulder harness. It shared it with everybody. Nobody tells anybody anything. When the federal government required voluntary assessment of crashes, only 18 of 80 companies responded. Hmm. So the mayor is allowing these vehicles to go on the street without the kind of rigors that we should have, that every crash must be reported, every incident must be reported. They've already been found out that they're not being truthful. Cruise struck a woman, actually another car, conventional car struck a woman. This is a few months ago. The woman ended up on the cruise car, under the cruise car. The cruise car stopped and then dragged the woman. No. Now, Cruise only reported the first part of it in the beginning, and they didn't report the second part. They were caught in a bald-faced lie. So Cruise can no longer operate in San Francisco. Waymo is probably far ahead of any of the others, but still there are problems with Waymo vehicles. The stats that I looked at, these vehicles do get into crashes more frequently than your conventional car. Your average driver does not get into a fatal crash in the United States for about 75 million miles. Now, that's a hard barrier for an autonomous vehicle to achieve, going 75 million miles without a fatality. In Europe, by the way, it's like 300 or 400 million miles. Our fatality rate is really the worst among developed countries.
Why?
I think, you know, the whole cowboy attitudes that we have post-COVID, of the 30 most developed countries in the OECD, 28 of them went down in traffic crashes. We were the only ones, along with Sweden, for whatever reason, that went up in traffic fatalities. In New York City, the police were writing 1 million summonses in 2018. Now they're writing about 700,000 summonses. There's a degree of lawlessness, especially post-COVID, that I'm seeing on the roads that I haven't seen in nearly 60 years. And I was a cab driver in the 1960s.
And listeners, who has a question? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Beyond that, who has an experience? Have you ever been in one? Have you ever worked on developing one? Questions or stories or your anxieties or your reassurances? Welcome here for my guest, Sam Schwartz. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call or text. And Nate on the Lower East Side, I think, has a story from what, Nate, today?
Yeah, actually today. Thank you, Brian, for taking my phone call. I'm an Uber driver. I've called in before, and I appreciate that I get through sometimes. I literally, when I heard this, I'm coming back from Greenwich, Connecticut. I will not drive with a passenger in the car, but Tesla is now offering full self-driving for 1 month to owners of Teslas, and I accepted it. On my way back from dropping off a passenger, I said, let me give it a try. And I made it back in one piece. It was incredibly, almost intuitive. It seemed like it knew what it was. Yeah, it seemed to know what it was doing. It would pass cars. It had no trouble with merges or anything like that. It sounds like I'm countering what your guest is saying. I'm not. I don't believe that it's a good idea to have self-driving in New York City at this point.
You had a good experience with it today.
I had a good experience with it. I also told the screener, there's a difference between full self-driving and autopilot. Tesla has both, and all Teslas come with autopilot as standard equipment in the car. And that's basically an upgraded version of cruise control. You know, so you're driving along. It doesn't have to be a straight line. It will follow the roadway and whatnot, and it'll slow down when it gets next to other cars. But it won't stop at lights. It won't stop at signs or anything. And one thing that I don't think is being mentioned is that you actually have to grab the wheel periodically. And it makes sure that it's not like a rhythmic thing, so that you're not sure when it's going to happen. The car needs to know that you're paying attention.
Wow. So you mean it kind of randomly says, hey, human, touch me so I know you're there?
Right. You have to grip the wheel. And there isn't an exact spot where you need to grip. So you'll find yourself gripping at the wheel. The way that they want you to do it is to, when you're using a full self-driving, is you actually have your hands on the wheel. And Nate, they have eye tracking. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Keep calling us. Nate, stay safe out there as an Uber driver. We love our Uber and Lyft and taxi drivers, no matter what kind of vehicle you drive, you're always welcome to call this show and talk about your experiences, drivers out there taking passengers for a living. And so we got that call, Sam, really interesting. And we got this text, also about Tesla. I've had a Tesla Model 3 since 2020. Most days I experience driving situations that simply won't be decipherable by an autonomous vehicle. Can a car make eye contact and decipher a hand gesture suggesting go ahead? This technology is a long, long, long way from being road ready, writes that listener. I do have a question about that. Because advocates for autonomous vehicles say it could make streets safer for everybody if there was enough of a concentration of them, a critical mass of autonomous vehicles, because even though they feel unsafe because we don't have control, that's a psychological thing on the part of human beings, they are statistically much safer drivers than human beings. Is there evidence one way or another about that?
Yeah, statistically, so far, they're not. I've been able to count about 25 fatalities, many of them in Teslas. There is no central reporting of it. When I look at how often a Waymo or a Cruise gets into a crash, it's about every 50,000 miles driven, whereas your average driver is every 500,000 miles. So there is no evidence yet other than what is reported by the companies. Now, Brian, this self-certification is crazy. Imagine if drug companies did self-certification and we didn't have some oversight. So for the mayor, and this mayor is not alone, just about everybody has said, go ahead with self-certification. We'll trust you.
Why?
So there is this belief that the technology is going to provide us with gardens of Eden where there'll be no pollution, there'll be no traffic jams. Brian, you can cut down on fatalities by 95% per mile traveled. You know how? Get on the subway. Subways are 95% safer, even with the murders, than going in a car. So you can save lives. If we look at France is already down by 2/3 in terms of the number of fatalities compared to us. Sweden is about 1/7 of us in fatalities. We're just allowing bigger cars, faster cars, and we're corralling pedestrians. Right. Not here in New York. New York has one piece of good news. Pedestrian fatalities have doubled since 2010 in the United States. In New York City, they've gone down. That's pretty impressive.
Vision zero from better intersection engineering and things like that?
Yeah, particularly when they do things like put these traffic islands in the middle, make narrower lanes, don't follow the federal standards of 12-foot lanes, leading pedestrian intervals. The city's done a damn good job in terms of pedestrians, not such a good job in terms of occupant fatalities, motorcycle fatalities, and bike fatalities.
Lisa in New Rochelle has an experience to share. Lisa, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. So we just got the full self-driving update 2 days ago. And so me and my 16-year-old son have been using it a lot and loving it. And it seems so much safer than an ordinary driver because, it sees everything and it anticipates things. So we've been driving in a very congested city, downtown New Rochelle and near his high school. And if people are waiting on the side to cross in a crosswalk, it will stop where I might not have stopped. I might have thought, oh, there's plenty of time to get through, but it will stop. Or we drove past a construction site and one of the workers standing really close to the side of the road. I would have kept going and just waited. I think he was going to let me pass, but the car decided to stop for this person and let him go. I hope I don't sound like a bad driver, but the truth is I just felt like it was driving so well. It was more cautious, but it seemed to know when it could make the turn and when a right turn on red was allowed. And it was even able to double park, which my 16-year-old son can't even do yet. So we were really, really impressed with it. And it seems to me to be much safer than a human.
So there's a question. Who would you trust more, an autonomous car or a 16-year-old? Lisa, thank you very much for your anecdote. You know, it leads me to a question that I hadn't thought of until she was talking, Sam, and that is, can you set your autonomous vehicle for different levels of caution? Computers are so programmable in so many ways. Can you, and you know, and we know that different human beings drive very differently in terms of levels of caution, even if they're driving legally in every case. Can they be programmed that way?
Well, I think that's what government has to insist upon. That's exactly one of my recommendations, is that we have we have street typology. What that means is there are some streets that are pedestrian only. There are some streets in which you can't go more than a walking speed, 5 miles an hour. Some are school streets at 15 or 20 miles an hour. All that is doable. They tried to do speed governors in the 1920s in Cincinnati, and the auto industry beat them back. I think if we're going to allow autonomous vehicles, we have to be able to control the autonomous vehicles, set a street typology, and make them all follow that. But I'm not against autonomous vehicles. I don't want you to get that wrong. I just believe we shouldn't be doing the cars first. We should be doing it as transit, still have an operator. Huh. But all the technology that would make a bus safer can easily be installed in buses. And the driver, just needs practically to drive it like you drive a train. You merely make it go forward and you stop it. You open the doors and you close the doors.
The Transport Workers Union would have something to say about that idea, right?
Well, that's why I keep an operator on the vehicle. You don't need, there is technology now in which the vehicle can follow such a precise path. You'll still have the bus driver or bus operator there. That person will be watching the doors. That person will be accelerating, decelerating. So the Port Authority did do a test of connected autonomous buses. I attended that out in JFK Airport. And they worked beautifully. The first bus talked to the second bus and the third bus, but then a pigeon flew between the two buses and the bus stopped. So there's lots of different things that happen that you as a driver wouldn't hesitate to continue to go, or you may even not stop.
Right.
Imagine in a tree branch that's waving in front of you. Well, the trajectory of that tree branch by physics looks like it's going to land in front of you.
Yeah.
And so the vehicle may stop. I do want to say something about those Tesla drivers.
Yeah.
Keep your eye on the road. Teslas have been known to crash into emergency vehicles on highways. And my belief is that the algorithm, they're following a vehicle doing 70 miles an hour. That vehicle sees an emergency vehicle in front of them. Pulls out. The Tesla vehicle's decision making says, wait, the vehicle was going at 70, now it's going at 0. Ignore that, and crashes into these vehicles.
Hmm.
So, Tesla's done amazing things, but Tesla will actually had a warning until last year that said full self-driving may do the wrong thing at the worst time.
Hmm.
Keep your eyes on the road and your hands by the wheel.
We have 30 seconds left. Just tell us, by way of background, if Mayor Adams is making this announcement now because he says it's inevitable for it to come to New York, where in America are autonomous vehicles already on the road? And who's behind this? Is it the taxi-ish companies like Uber, who mostly want this? Is it delivery companies delivering for Amazon or something like that? And is it already happening in other cities? 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's already happening in San Francisco, Waymo, and until recently, Cruise, which got kicked off. Places with good weather, Los Angeles is the next big city that's being tried. Tempe, Arizona, Phoenix. some Austin and a few others. They are trying it in good weather conditions. They don't know yet if it'll work when we have snow on the ground or, you know, horrible fog and rain.
And who's making the money? Who's got the vested interest? Just to finish that question.
Yeah, right now it's the tech companies, but there are about 300 different companies that are investing in this area. Some of them are going out of business pretty quickly, but the intent is to get rid of the Uber, the Lyft driver, the taxi driver, and have robo-taxis.
Sam Schwartz, former longtime Gridlock Sam columnist in the Daily News, former New York City Traffic Commissioner, President and CEO of Sam Schwartz Pedestrian Traffic Management, and author of the book No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars and the Road of the Future, which is now the road of the very near future in New York City after Mayor Adams' announcement last week. Sam, thanks a lot.
You're quite welcome, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and for just our last 10 minutes today, let's have a little fun with words. This time it's a call-in on English language words and phrases that don't exist in any other language that you may speak. Again, a call-in on English language words and phrases that don't exist in any other language that you may speak. Who's got an example? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Why are we doing this? Because on this show, we've had the opportunity in the past to invite all of you to teach us words from your other culture of origin that might not exist in English. So we thought today, just for the fun of it, we're going to flip that script and ask something that we haven't asked before. If you speak multiple languages, if English is your first or second or third or fourth language, what's one example of a word or a phrase you use in English that you don't have a translation for in your other tongue? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call or text. This is a good one for texts because we don't have much time and you can do this one short. But also call us, 212-433-9692. This phenomenon is sometimes referred to as a loan word. And if it's an English loan, a lot of them seem to be examples of the United States influence around the world, right? So the word okay is used in a lot of other places now where they don't speak English. Stop signs are called stop signs, I read this morning, in parts of the world that are not English speaking. And of course, advancements in the U.S. have changed lexicons all over the world. Telephone, that is advancements in technology, telephone, email, podcast seem to be examples of this, you name it. But what about concepts? And what do you think an English loan word might convey about the culture that you come from that doesn't have that word? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. A call is now often used to refer to a business call, but a call to your mom or your best friend is still a chiamata in Italian. Are there certain work-related or business-related words in your native language that are very obviously, of American origin? 212-433-9692. In Japan, another example, you might say salaryman to talk about a white-collar worker, or even put a Japanese ending on an English word. We've seen examples of this, like endingu, to mean ending. How many of you out there say the word parking in your native language to refer to a parking lot? It seems to have spread from English. So there are some examples. You give us yours. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call or text. We'll take them after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and okay, now to your calls on English language words and phrases that don't exist in any other language that you may speak. We'll start with a text. Listener writes, arm and hand are the same word in Tamil. I'm a heritage Tamil speaker, and it would drive me nuts that there's no distinction between arm and hand. Vivian in Harlem. You're on WNYC. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, Brian. I just have the word loitering, which doesn't exist in Spanish at all. You would have to write two sentences in order to explain what loitering means in English.
Is there a cultural underlay of that? Like, people don't perceive it as a problem if people are hanging around on the corner as much as in this country or something?
Well, yeah, it's also cultural, but it's very hard to explain what that word means in English, because English is very efficient. In Spanish, we tend to explain and write more words in order to say one thing.
Yes. Thank you, Vivian. Thank you. Call us again. Julie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Hi. And I am a native English speaker. I lived in Italy and worked there. And they don't have looking forward to seeing you. They say their literal, the translation is can't wait to see you. So with work emails or in a situation that's less than I can't wait to see you, there's like nothing you can say like looking forward to seeing you or looking forward to going. And so, I've mm-hmm. asked everyone. Yeah, it's interesting. I've asked everyone, and they don't. So I just use English if I need to.
Thank you very much. Here's another one that's going to relate to Italian. Lynn in Whitestone. You're on WNYC. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Okay, so I am not a heritage speaker of Italian, but I studied Italian and I lived in Italy in the 1980s, and Italian is a completely phonetic language. In other words, if you say a word, you automatically know how to spell it. So they don't have a word for spell. And instead of asking how do you spell that, you have to say how is that written? How do you write that?
Uh-huh. And no
Hello?
Word for spell per se. Lynn, I gotcha. Thank you very much. Let's see. Text message says, spoiler alert, has no translation in French that I know of. Another one pertaining to French listener writes, in French here in Canada, we often use English words for the French words because the French words take too much time or too much space. Also on French, one of our producers fed us this one. In French, you would say le weekend when talking about what you're going to do over the weekend. And during the weekend, you might dress a bit more casually in les jeans, even though denim as a fabric is a French invention. So that's interesting. Jesse in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. Chinese has no word for salad because there's no history of eating salads.
There you go. No word for salad in Chinese. And here's another Chinese speaker, Andy in Middletown, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Andy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I taught English in Taiwan for several years, and there are lots of words in English that don't exist in Chinese that gave my students a lot of trouble. So there are no articles, words like the and it was very difficult for students to master how those are used because they just don't exist in Chinese. There are far fewer prepositions. The word for he and she are the same word as they're pronounced in Chinese. They're both ta. So that would really cause people a lot of trouble. They would say she when they meant he. They would say he when they meant she.
And that would relate back to, that would probably start a very interesting conversation with Judith Butler from our last segment. And that's all the time we have. Thanks for those smattering of English language words that don't exist in other languages that you may speak. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.